I'm joined on the line by Andrew Netty, whose new book, Ghost Money, is out now. Andrew, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you very much. A bit cold. It's a bit cold in Melbourne today, but aside from that, very good.
That's good, that's good. Andrew, Ghost Money is out now through Crimewave Press, and I had a look at it. Haven't had a chance to finish it because I can't quite read that fast. But can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, essentially, the story is set in the mid-90s in Cambodia. It's a sort of hard-boiled crime story, I suppose, set in the mid-90s in Cambodia, a time of considerable instability in the country, where the Khmer Rouge were, I suppose, on their last legs in some degree, but still causing a lot of concerns. The country was ruled by a very unstable coalition government made up of former enemies, and it was still a very poor country. And in some respects, it was a very broken country. I worked in the mid-90s in Cambodia. I was a journalist there. And it was a very broken country. It was a startlingly beautiful country as well. The book is set amidst the first split that happened in the Khmer Rouge. It's basically it starts off as a missing person story. An Australian businessman goes missing in Cambodia, and an Australian Vietnamese policeman, an ex-cop, is hired to go and find him.
Mm. It is a very nicely put together novel. It's I'm looking forward to it. It is, as you say, you make Cambodia look amazing. It reads beautifully through the descriptions and things. I suppose the big bonus of that was you were there, but why were you in Cambodia in the mid-90s?
Well, I first went overseas. I lived in Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia and Thailand for about 7 years with my partner in the mid-90s, or sort of from the early 90s to the mid-90s, really. I had worked on and off in Cambodia as a journalist. I had a job for about 6 months on a wire service, which just happened. I was filling in for a journalist who was away, which just happened to coincide with the first big major public split in the Khmer Rouge, which was sort of, as I'm sure your listeners will know, was the sort of pseudo-Maoist sort of group who ruled Cambodia for a few brief years in the 70s and basically turned the country into just an open charnel house. Mm. It was the first big public split they had, was in 1996. I mean, as we now know, actually they'd been splitting and breaking up for some time before that, but that was all private. So I was essentially covering that.
Mm. Is it strange how these Maoist groups fragment to buggery? I don't know why. Yes. Anyway, you've lived a pretty adventurous life. You've been all over Southeast Asia. You've worked as a journalist. But how did you first come to sit down and start writing fiction?
Well, I started the book in 96. I was working as a journalist in 96. And I just thought, I loved crime fiction. I still love crime fiction. I sat down and I thought, look, this is an amazing place to set a crime story. Cambodia, I mean, it was a startlingly beautiful country. It was quite a harsh country. It was a real place of extremes, to some degree it still is. I mean, things happened on a daily basis that literally you just couldn't make up, I thought. Great things and also very terrible things. And I thought, this is an amazing place to set a crime story. And at that time, there wasn't a lot of crime fiction set in Asia. I still don't think there really is, for various reasons. There'd been one book written in Cambodia, which was written about Cambodia, one crime novel, which was by a Bangkok-based journalist called Christopher Moore, who'd set a novel in about 92. That was when the UN had basically come in, brokered a ceasefire between the various warring factions in Cambodia, and they'd come in and were trying to police that ceasefire. Nothing really had been written since then. I thought it was a great place to set a novel. So I started in 96, but I was just too busy working as a journalist. There was too much to do, and quite frankly, there was a bit too much drinking and staying up late and all that kind of stuff as well to really focus on it. So many years later, I just thought, look, I need to do this. So my family and I basically went as my partner and my daughter. We basically went and lived in Cambodia for a year. That was in 2008, which was fantastic. I got to write the first draft of the novel. I also got to go back to a whole lot of places in Cambodia that had basically been off limits to Westerners in the in the 90s. So that, and that's when I wrote the first draft of the novel.
Is Cambodia recovering? We hear very little. Well, I hear very little here about Cambodia. We don't hear a lot about it now. But you've been back in the last, 2008. Has it? Yeah. Is it healing?
Look, I think that's a really interesting question. Look, I think there's a number of ways to approach that question. On one level, no. On one level, the scars run deep from the Khmer Rouge period, a very traumatic, bloody period in their history. But I think more to the point, the style of leadership, the autocratic, I suppose, sort of heavy-fisted way of running a country, that's still very much the way that Cambodia is run. The current government's been basically in power since the 90s. Pretty corrupt government, pretty iron-fisted government. So the style, a similar style, my Khmer friends often say that. Sort of, basically, it's being run in the same style that it has been, you could argue, since the 50s under Sihanouk and before that. So the political culture has not changed and is still very damaged, I think. Economically, the place is much better off, albeit the benefits of economic growth are disproportionately being shared. But look, it's undoubtedly the place is better off economically. There's no civil war now. That's a huge thing. It's a huge thing. You can't understate. You can't overstate that. Hmm. I mean, I think that the most interesting thing about Cambodia, one of the most interesting differences I noticed between going back in 2008 and when I've been back since, and the 90s, is sort of the youth quake. You go back now and there's just so many young people. They're out there, they're really, they're living their lives, they're on the streets. It's a very young population. That young population is starting to get quite restive, I think, and they're starting to think, hang on a second, you know, I want a job, I want to be able to have a fair shot at life, I don't want all this corruption. So, I mean, I think, I must admit, I thought it would take longer than it has taken, but they're really starting to make themselves heard. Mm-hmm. The last election, the government nearly lost, or the government came very close to losing, which is something that no one had predicted. And that's essentially, I put that down essentially to that youth quake that's happening in Cambodian society. It's having significant implications, which are going to be felt far quicker than I think we thought they were going to be felt. So look, yes, the place has a lot of problems, but it is moving ahead, I think. And you know, you can't overstate the difference it makes not having a sort of protracted intercenine civil war still going on. You know, that's changed the whole country.
Yes, it would. I mean, you can't actually progress while anything like that's happening.
No, and in some respects, the political problem in Cambodia, I think, comes down to the fact that it's the older generation, both the opposition and the Cambodian People's Party, who are the government, who are basically still in charge. Mm. You know, that group, you need to clear that group out and start again in some respects. That's not going to probably happen, but that would be the optimal scenario.
Yeah, but that's hard work. That's going to be hard work. Now,
and people with power don't like to go.
No, that's funny that.
And never have anywhere.
No, funny that, yes. Andrew, now, you have written an awful lot of pulp and crime work over the years. What is it about crime fiction that appeals to you?
I think, I mean, I tried to do this with Ghost Money. Crime fiction is the best vehicle, I think, in terms of fiction, to be able to discuss social issues and look at how societies function, without a doubt. I think that's what crime fiction does. The best crime fiction, in my view, does. If you think about where some of the most exciting crime fiction is coming out of, I think it's. I personally don't think it's the Nordic countries. You know, the Nordic genre, which dominates crime fiction at the moment. Although there's some good stuff there, but I think it's in places like South Africa, in Asia, places that are going through major transitions, and the crime fiction that's coming out of there is really first rate.
So, how did you end up at Crime Wave Press? Are the two linked?
No, they're not. I mean, I sort of know Tom, the publisher, from social media. He'd read my book and had liked it. It actually had been published previously in the US, but I was looking for a new publisher, and I thought because of the Asian content, an Asian-based publisher, Crime Wave Press is based in Hong Kong, would be good. So Tom was very keen to take it. And I'm now very keen to write a sequel on the basis of that now. I'm quite inspired by that.
Now, you're also into pulp, and every time I say that, I feel like I should be on a cooking program. And now we've got Andrew Netty, and he's going to teach us all about pulp. Andrew, tell us about jam. Nothing to do with that. Pulp, which is something I've never been sure about. I watched Pulp Fiction and thought, is this pulp? Is this fiction? I don't know. But you have Pulp Curry, and I looked at that, and you made me go away and find a copy of Chain Reaction. God, that
really?
Took some bloody doing, too. I've got to sit down and watch
it. You probably picked one of the harder books there on the site, yes?
Oh, no, I had to find the film. I can't get the book.
I got the film. Great film.
That took some doing. And you made me ring up my father and say, are my copies of Mad Max still under the bed? Oh, yes. Well, apparently they're worth a fortune. But Pulp Curry is a great site. How did Pulp Curry come into being?
Oh, well, authors these days, you've all got to have a site. That's what we're told. Or as it's often referred to, your authorial piece of real estate. But look, Pulp Curry, so that's www.pulpcurry.com. That's my author site. But it's also turned into a site where I write about movies, books, and I also do a lot of work, as you say, on pulp fiction, both Australian pulp fiction, but also really from all over the world. Every Friday, I've done a lot of interviews with sort of academics who've researched pulp, and every Friday, more or less, I try and post about one book or a set of books and just discuss the book, who wrote it, the cover, look at it in a bit more in-depth, in a bit more of an in-depth way than just sort of go look at those amazing covers. Because, I mean, that's the interesting thing about pulp fiction. The current pulp fiction's very popular at the moment, I suppose, in certain circles, and that's mainly based on the sort of outrageous, lurid nature of the cover art. But there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, that was what I got the impression of. All these years, I've seen pulp fiction books in secondhand markets, and I thought, God, how does anybody read something? How can you take that seriously with a cover like that? And a friend of mine said, well, what happens if you put it on an e-reader? You don't see the cover. You have to focus on the literature. And he was right. Pulp fiction can actually be incredibly good if you can get past the cover.
That's right. And some of it, look, it's like a lot. It's a lot of it produced. And I know, because I've got a book coming out with another person towards the end of the year, which is a sort of a history of youth culture and pulp fiction. About 2 years ago, I stopped just writing about the covers and the books as artifacts and actually started reading them. I had to read them for this book. And I discovered that while a lot of it is dross, there is some amazing stuff there. It has energy, it has authenticity, and it's certainly in the Australian context, a lot of the 60s pulp fiction is far more authentic about what was happening in Australia than, I suppose, so-called mainstream publishing during that same period.
Yes, very true. Because mainstream publishing during the period was very, very, very conservative at the time, whereas pulp fiction would have been bang it out for a buck, write what you like.
Well, Australian publishing in the 60s, the Boys Club, it was by and large, I think it's a generalisation, but it certainly was it was run like a bit of a club. It was very British-centric, so we were republishing a lot of British stuff. And it wasn't really seen as, I mean, there's a very famous book called There's a Weird Mob. They're a Weird Mob, which you might have heard of, which is about sort of, I suppose, the experiences in Australia of, I think he's an Italian migrant.
Yes.
and his experiences coming to grips with Australian culture. That book was a huge hit when it was published, but it was shopped around before that. It was shopped around to all these mainstream Australian publishers who just thought, we don't want to publish this. This is garbage. Mm. So you know that they didn't have an ear for what was popular. They didn't have an ear for, I suppose, for popular fiction, and they just turned their nose up at it. Mm. And that really happened. That was really the case in Australian publishing until the early 70s. Pulp fiction, meanwhile, was far more commercially oriented. You had pulp publishers like Horwitz Publications. They were knocking out 20 books a month. They were doing print runs of about 20,000 a book. This is in the sort of mid to late 60s. Mm. And they were writing books about Australia. They were writing books set in King's Cross. They were writing books about, you know, Allied nurses and Japanese prisoner of war camps and the terrible times they had. I mean, in some respects, it's trash, but it taps into a sort of subcultural memory in Australia that's going on at that time.
Mm. It is, yes, it is a snapshot of youth culture of the period in which you can see what youth is looking for and what people are thinking that youth are looking for. It is actually a quite an interesting subgenre of publishing at the time. Mm. Mm.
And everyone had pulp. Even Cambodia had pulp in its own way.
Yeah.
I have seen, and they still do to some degree, although if you go to Phnom Penh and you go to one of the, you know, the news stalls that are all over the city, they sell these crappy little magazines, these cheaply put together magazines, which are just full of sort of pulp horror stories. Pulp horror stories are their big thing. Not so much crime.
Yeah.
There's far too much crime in real-life Cambodia for Cambodians to really want to have to write about it. But they love their horror stories.
There is very little pulp in China. There's no scope for it. You have to conform. Otherwise, you can't get it out there. Even trying to put it on the internet, you'd have to publish it externally and hope that somebody could access it internally.
Well, my understanding is also there's actually not a great deal of crime fiction in China either. I mean, if you're looking
you can't have crime. If no, you have crime, right. The criminal has to be caught and executed at the end of the novel.
That's right. That's right. There's expatriate Chinese who are writing crime about China, but very few. I mean, I think there is one writer I've been reading whose book. And now I can't remember the name, but the one of his I read, I think it was called Snow Devils.
Yeah, sounds familiar.
And it was about an expatriate China. It was about a Chinese lawyer who'd worked in the US and returned to China and basically had set up a legal practice in China. Interesting book in the sense that it was a actual indigenous crime novel.
Yeah.
As opposed to someone sitting in LA writing a crime novel about China.
Yeah, but it's the fiction here is pap fiction. It's just the same rubbish over and over again. How happy everybody is, and how wonderful life is. And you're thinking,
yep.
Who's writing this? Have they looked out of a window? Yeah. So, Andrew, Ghost Money's out now, and you've got Pulp Fiction and Youth Culture, 1950 to 1980, coming out towards the end of the year. But what's next for you at the moment?
We're writing a second pulp fiction history, mm-hmm. which is about sort of pulp and popular fiction influenced by the radical movements of the 60s, so black power, feminism, the anti-Vietnam War movement. So that book, I'm in the middle of researching that book at the moment with my co-editor.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing a whole lot of stories, short stories, and I want to try. I've got another novel which is sort of out there in the ether, and I want to try. I'm quite keen and have been for a while to sort of do another Max Quinlan book. Max Quinlan is the Vietnamese Australian ex cop who is in my first novel, Ghost Money. I'm quite keen to do a sequel.
I think that would be a winner. Based on, now I've got to clarify this again because people go, have you read this book? Yes, of course I've read most of it. I just haven't finished it. He's a great character. I think you've developed him very nicely. I think he is a lovely, rich character. I think you can there is more to Max Quinlan than you've put in Ghost Money, I think a sequel would be fantastic.
Well, thank you very much.
And I would love to talk to you again, either when that comes out or when your book on Pulp Fiction comes out.
No, absolutely. That'd be great.
Well, Andrew, it's been lovely having you on today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.